Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Jones Research Fireside Chat with Feminist Senior Management to discuss the challenges, opportunities, and infertility services. Joining me today are Kathy Lee Sepsic, CEO and founder of Femisys, and Dr. Jim Liu, Chief Medical Officer. Kathy Lee Sepsic is founder of Femisys, has nearly 3 decades of experience as a senior executive in the medical technology industry. The lead inventor of the technologies at Femisys is committed to advancing technology in women's health. Dr. Liu has served as chairman, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at University Hospital Health System, the chair, Department of Reproductive Biology at Case Western Reserve University, and division head, Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the University of Cincinnati. He now serves as chief medical officer of Femisys. As a reminder to the audience, if you would like to submit a question, please use the Q&A button on your Zoom toolbar. We'll try to answer questions at the end of the call if time permits. And now for our speakers, just want to get some agreements out of the way. So first, this call will be recorded so that can be transcribed. And second, you understand the definition of material non-public information and agree not to disclose any such information or any other confidential information during this interview. Do you agree?
We agree.
We agree.
Great. Well, let's start with Dr. Liu then to give us a background on infertility services in the US from a clinician standpoint. So, first, I guess if you can provide information about your prior practice, how many individuals were you seeing on an annual basis? What kind of fertility services did you provide and are available?
Sure. As the chair in my former practice, I saw patients 3 days a week, roughly three new infertility patients per session, so about nine new patients per week. And I did perform procedures such as intrauterine insemination, pelvic ultrasound to look at the woman patient, as well as intrauterine insemination, in vitro fertilization, and I managed in vitro fertilization cycles. Embryo transfers, frozen embryo transfers, went over genetic data on the embryos with the couple. We provided a whole host of infertility services from the beginning to the end, pregnancy.
Great. And you provided a little bit of background on the market, but are there any other types of reproductive technology that are available? And why do people choose assisted reproductive technologies, also known as ART?
So ART accompanies a whole host of services from as simple as giving medication to stimulate a woman to ovulate more than one egg or to stimulate her to ovulate to release the egg. It also is in a less intense intrauterine insemination where the sperm is washed and then placed into the uterus via a small catheter, usually like a pelvic examination, and then in vitro fertilization, where the woman receives fertility medications, usually in the form of injections on a daily basis. And then after about 10 to 14 days, a surgical procedure involving some anesthesia to retrieve the eggs because the ovaries are internal. And once the eggs are identified, it's exposed to sperm or injected with sperm, depending on the situation. And then the embryos are grown in a laboratory until about the fifth day. At that point, they are either one or two embryos are frozen, one or two embryos are transferred, and the remaining embryos are frozen, or there is, if the woman is older, or has a genetic problem, the embryo undergoes a microscopic biopsy of one of the cells of the embryo. So usually we get about 10 to 15 cells, and then they are sent off for DNA analysis to look at the chromosomes or a specific gene that we want to avoid a woman carrying a genetic defect. And then the remainder of the embryos are frozen until the results come back. And the normal embryo then is then transferred to a woman in a subsequent cycle. So it can be pretty complex, many, many interventions. And with each level of intervention, there is a cost associated with it.
Can you, discuss further about the financial costs associated with a typical IVF cycle? How much are people typically paying for these, and are they covered by insurance?
Certainly. Insurance does usually cover the initial evaluation, so including lab tests on the woman and many times the male in terms of the sperm count. It doesn't usually always cover intrauterine insemination. So those costs include the insemination itself, which may range from $100 to $200 just to do the insemination. And then the processing of the sperm to wash the sperm, which is another $200 to $300. So $500 for that, roughly. And this is Midwest prices, so it may be higher on the East and West Coast. And then in vitro fertilization, the range for most individuals is above 25,000 when you count all the different steps that I've outlined. And it can be much more than that if genetic analysis is done, because for each embryo that is analyzed for DNA, there's a cost per embryo. So all of those procedures add to the cost. So it may range from as little as 25,000 to achieve a pregnancy if she's successful on the first cycle to as much as five, six figures for a pregnancy. And insurance is beginning to cover more of it, but most of it is out of pocket for most couples.
How large would you estimate the market is for IVF, and then for infertility services overall?
Well, the infertility services is increasing as women delay childbearing for a variety of reasons, mainly career purposes. So they're getting married at a later age, so late 20s, early 30s, and attempting pregnancy sometimes even in their late 30s and early 40s. So that's number one. What was the other question? Can you repeat?
Other than IVF, infertility services overall.
Yeah, so intrauterine insemination is one of the more common procedures. It's performed much more common than in vitro. And in general, it is one of the first procedures that we use to treat infertile couples, generally for number one, timing purposes. Couples may have a variety of issues with their careers, like airline pilots and flight attendants, who might be in different places at different times. So timing is one. Secondly, for male factor infertility, where it's about 40 to 50% of couples present with a male factor infertility, either low sperm count, low sperm motility, variety of issues that fall into that category. And so those individuals would be candidates for intrauterine insemination, which is the least costly of most of our interventions.
And what are some reasons outside of infertility that someone might choose to use assisted reproductive technology?
Certainly. We treat same-sex couples, so they may use a sperm donor. Generally, we recommend using an anonymous sperm donor as opposed to a known individual because of just screening purposes and to prevent sexually transmitted diseases from being transmitted. So we always use frozen sperm that has been tested for sexually transmitted diseases, etc. And also single women that are older and decided that they do not want a partner and want to raise a child on their own.
Great. And I think you've already described IUI. But if you have any other details that you want to discuss about the IUI cycle before we move on, differences in cost feasibility versus IVF, and differences in how widely used it is.
It is definitely more widely used than IVF by far. It is usually one of the first interventions that we do, assuming that the woman has open fallopian tubes, that she is able to ovulate or be stimulated to ovulate, and the male can produce adequate sperm. Even certainly sperm, modal sperm in greater than 1 million when it's washed. Those are the individuals that are candidates. And we usually don't perform it more than about three times because the success rates fall off dramatically after the third try and they move on to IVF.
Right, that makes sense. I'm going to move on to Kathy for a little bit to discuss her views on the infertility market. Dr. Liu has already touched on this, but can you talk to me about how you see the infertility landscape, how many people in the US experience this and use assisted reproductive technologies?
So it's pretty well documented. So it's about 10 million women that are struggling with infertility. So it's a pretty widespread problem. As Dr. Liu mentioned, we see about 40 to 50% of the contributing factor being related to the male. We also see sharply declining sperm counts. This is now very well published around the world, where the sperm counts have declined by over 50%. So the landscape, unfortunately, we see declining fertility rates here in the US. We're seeing it around the world. That's a significant issue. And cost is a problem. We see inflation. We see people very conscientious about the financial burden. And oftentimes the journey does not result in a couple ending up with, exposed to ART procedures or in vitro fertilization. In fact, very few end up there. So part of what Femisys' mission has been from day one is to develop products that allow for accessibility, allow for people to engage in a lower cost alternative so that we can get people to come off the sidelines, whether they be a couple that's infertile, a male factor, a female factor, a same-sex couple, a single woman looking to inseminate, that we give these options. So we see the market growing. We see there be a dearth of innovation at the front end of infertility treatments. Most of what's been advanced has been on the more sophisticated side of IVF and ICSI and egg, maintenance. But we don't see much happening on the front end, which is where we focused. So that's been, our mission from day one, and that's kind of what we're trying to bring to fruition.
Right. And Femisys has, a portfolio of products. What are some of the products that Femisys has for infertility services? We were talking about Femicide, but can you talk a little bit more about the portfolio as well?
Sure. We have another product that was developed for the diagnosis of fallopian tubes. And Dr. Liu mentioned that in order to do an insemination procedure, a woman needs to have at least an open fallopian tube. Natural conception or fertilization happens in the tube. So if she has both tubes blocked, that then prevents that from being an option for her. So the initial diagnosis and workup is really critical. And up until the development of our FemView product, the typical way that that would be assessed would be to send the patient to radiology. It's a referral. It's done under radiation exposure, contrast dye. It tends to be more expensive, and it's an added step in the process. So the development and the advent of FemView allows for the procedure and the analysis to occur on the same visit, so that the physician can look at all of the potential female factors and be able to come up with a treatment plan. So that was our very first product that we introduced for the infertility diagnosis. From a company standpoint, we have not completely supported the commercial effort. We've been holding in that regard to wait for a therapeutic option to couple into and to make it cost affordable for us to approach the market with more than one product. So Femicide, as you mentioned, is our intratubal insemination product that's more therapeutic. That would be an alternative to an IUI. And that now allows us as a company to combine those two products, which are essential and work together. FemView determines if she has an open tube or both open tubes, and then Femicide allows for the insemination to that open tube. So.
That's helpful. And you've talked a lot about the policy side of things. Reproductive health has been in the news a lot lately. And you've touched on President Biden's executive order calling for $200 million investment in research in women's health, a coordinated approach from 20 federal government agencies. How do you see this impacting the women's health industry, both in terms of public companies as well as privates?
I mean, I think it's amazing. I think, you know, having the administration and having dollars earmarked specifically for women's health initiatives, it brings a spotlight to the area, and it acknowledges the fact that there is been such a lack of innovation for a major specialty that takes care of approximately 51% of our population. So that acknowledgement will hopefully spur innovation. I mean, for us as a company, we're further along. And look, fortunately, what we've read up on the initiatives is that they also not just want to spur early stage innovation and people new. It takes a long time to get there. You know, they're also earmarking funds and dollars to companies that are at the stage we are now with Femicide, those that have 510K clearances, they're ready to commercialize. How do we bring these technologies to the forefront faster so physicians can address their patients' needs now, not years down the line? For us as a company, we know that when we're talking government funding, sometimes it doesn't come as quick as we all hope. You know, I think the step one is that there's an acknowledgement and there's earmarked funds set aside. The deployment of that, I'm not so sure how fast that's going to come and how clear it is as far as what the deployment will look like. For us as a company, we were fortunate to be able to raise capital the end of last year. So we are in a comfortable cash position where we are going to be able to achieve the milestones that we've laid out ahead of us well into 2025 based on the capital that we've raised. But certainly we are going to explore every avenue now that there are several initiatives that have been announced, because that will help augment our efforts and that will help fortify, you know, the ability to be successful to get these products ultimately into the hands of women.
And what is your cash position and runway at this time?
So we have a runway into 20, a second half of 2025. We are going to have our K released March 28th, and that will give a current update on our cash position.
Great. And just to be clear, that runway includes Femicide commercial launch as well as other clinical trials.
It does.
Great. Well, then, while we're on the policy side of things, Dr. Liu, I'd like to get your opinion on one of the most pressing issues in reproductive health. The Alabama Supreme Court decision issued last month declaring that frozen embryos created through IVF should be considered children legally. You know, we've seen this halt IVF treatments in state, prompting the government to sign into a law protecting IVF treatments. How do you see this in initial ruling impacting IVF services within Alabama and in other jurisdictions?
So first of all, I was surprised by the ruling. Obviously, it is a continuation of the Roe v. Wade expansion by some of the observers on the outside. And certainly, there may be some states that are conservative and may follow a little bit in the Alabama mode. It does impact IVF programs, especially in Alabama, some of which paused their cycles to the dismay of patients living there. I think the big issue really is what to do with frozen embryos. As I described before, in most IVF cycles, there is an excess of embryos generated. And those embryos are frozen either for genetic analysis until those results are available to look for extra chromosomes, which would be resulting in birth defects or death in utero of the embryo. Also genetic diseases in which you're looking for a significant fatal gene that might be transmitted to the baby. So those embryos are going to be frozen. And now the question is what to do with those embryos? Will they be frozen forever? Normally defective embryos are discarded. So you're left with either keeping them frozen forever, donating the embryos to science in those limited states that have the ability to do so, or if their no embryos are normal, donating them to a couple to adopt. Some couples may choose not to do that. So there it raises a number of issues.
And You've mentioned that IVF typically creates more than one embryo. In the opinion, one of the justices in Alabama suggested that you could create I do IVF by creating a single embryo at a time. Can you talk about the feasibility of this suggestion and what kind of costs it would add to the procedure?
Certainly. It would tremendously lower the IVF success rates, number one, because we would stimulate multiple eggs in a typical cycle. So a single embryo being developed would be taking us back to the original IVF baby that was in England, which, in which case there was only one embryo created, and it would tremendously increase the cost. So the success rates with creating just a single embryo, it would push the IVF success rates from 40 to 50% for a typical couple down to maybe 10 or 11% for a, you know, $25,000 minimum cost. And you're looking at now babies that will run $150,000 to $200,000 per couple. So it would stymie, I think, the IVF success rates, and really put a tremendous handicap on infertile couples.
One of the talked about issues with IVF is the attrition rate. Can you talk about the attrition rate in each step of the IVF cycle, from collection to live birth? How many opportunities do we have at each stage?
Certainly. So a typical couple average age is somewhere between 34 and 35. There are some women at the age of 35 that have a reduced egg reserve. And so the stimulation with the fertility drugs, which are quite expensive, and the range is $2,000 to $10,000 of just medication costs to stimulate extra eggs, may not be successful. So there will be a percentage of couples that fail at that stage. If the couple does make it to egg retrieval under anesthesia, eggs are usually retrieved quite successfully, and we usually get 80 to 90% of the eggs from the ovary itself when we see them on ultrasound. We can then fertilize. The fertilization rate is quite high for most couples, but with some male factors, the fertilization rate might be much, much lower. So it may be in the below 30% because of either a male problem or an egg quality problem because the woman is older. And then there is the embryo testing stage, in which couples may not have normal embryos if the woman is, let's say, 42, almost 80% of her embryos will be found to have abnormal chromosomes, which is explaining the high miscarriage rates we see in spontaneous pregnancies in women in their 40s. So at each stage, there is a drop off. And so this is why the cost for a typical couple can be quite high for a pregnancy.
Do you see any potential downstream effects from the Alabama ruling to jurisdictions outside of Alabama and how those people might approach fertility services? I'm thinking specifically about those who might be cryogenically storing embryos. How are they responding to this news?
So this, let's take embryo storage for an example. It roughly costs $300 to $500 per year to store the embryos. Now, it doesn't cost more per embryo since they don't take a lot of room and they're frozen in liquid nitrogen in a straw. The cost of keeping the embryos frozen is somewhere between $300 to $500 per year for frozen embryos. And so that's an added cost that could be in perpetuity given the decision. What was the other issues that you had?
Any changes in the attitudes that people might have in jurisdictions outside of Alabama with this precedent? being
Yeah,
set.
so they may discourage couples from pursuing IVF, given the costs and perhaps the limited options with embryos of what to do with them, and so might discourage couples. It also would encourage, I think, political movements to try and protect the right to IVF, and so that will take some time and effort to do that.
Let's move on then to talk a little bit about this recent study focused specifically on male factor infertility. Can you define male factor infertility, in terms of total motile sperm count?
Well, as Kathy said, the average sperm counts have dropped dramatically in the last 50 years. And this is based on data from sperm banks, where they are actually screening males for potential don frozen embryo, frozen donor sperm. And so used to be a normal was 40 million. And now we're seeing 20 million as a quote normal from various laboratories. And our laboratory in the Midwest, where we practice, was 15 million. So it's gone down dramatically. The other is the motility, forward motility, where the sperm are swimming forward rather than in circles, which can happen. And that's 40% motility. So those are kind of ballpark figures, but it varies from laboratory to laboratory and country to country.
So
So that's male factor.
in the context of male factor infertility, we're thinking about the benefit of sperm placement directly into the fallopian tube, rather than traditional IUI.
So let's take a what happens physiologically if you're just trying to get pregnant on your own? The vast majority of sperm are lost in the vagina because the vagina is very hostile to sperm. It's usually acidic, which means that the sperm do not survive in the vagina for very long. The next is the cervix, which has mucus to protect the uterus from bacteria coming from the vagina. So the sperm has to penetrate the cervical mucus, which is another barrier. So you lose a lot of sperm in that process as well, those that survive the vagina. And then the uterus itself, the uterine lining has, it's not smooth. It has a lot of crevices, and white cells are in those crevices. So they get gobbled, some of the sperm that make it through the cervix then get gobbled up by white cells. Then they finally make it into the fallopian tube. So the Femicide device theoretically should avoid those barriers from the vagina, the cervix, and the uterine lining. And so that makes whatever sperm you can get on the washed specimen much more efficient. So the important thing is the time to pregnancy appears to be shortened by the device, which is very important, and its effectiveness in low sperm count situations is another, I think, important aspect. And so with that, the cost is much lower if you don't have to do so many inseminations.
Does it make sense to you that Femicide would be advantageous in low sperm count situations where IUI might not be?
That's a question I think Kathy can answer from the direct data that she has.
We'll talk,
But
we'll touch on that then in a little bit.
definitely, I think it would be an advantage. I have very limited experience with the actual Femicide device since I was only starting to look at the device when I left practice. So.
Just theoretically, though, you've described the direct insemination into the fallopian tube is a theoretical advantage
Yes,
over.
it is. And the fallopian tube actually promotes sperm survivability. So very little sperm is lost. The other thing that I want to make sure people understand, it takes more than one sperm to fertilize the egg. And that's a concept that people maybe not recognize. When the egg is released, it's not naked, it's surrounded by a lot of cells, which we call granulosa cells. And the first 200 to 300 sperm that get to the egg actually dissolve some of those cells around it. And then the final sperm can come in and fertilize. So it's not one sperm into the egg. The egg is not naked at the time that it's released naturally into the fallopian tube.
You've talked quite a bit about male factor infertility. What are some of the factors that are contributing to this? And what are the trends and projections that you've seen in terms of male factor infertility going forward?
Well, I mean, urologists, which treat a lot of the males, have limited options on trying to increase the sperm count. They have used some of the female fertility drugs to stimulate the testes to produce more sperm, and that has had very limited success, unfortunately. So almost all of the focus from the infertile couple point of view, from a practical standpoint, is intrauterine insemination with washed sperm and in vitro fertilization with sperm injection, which is called ICSI, ICSI, as the modes for treating male factor.
All right, then I think it's a good time to talk about the data that FEMACY presented this week. You reported a 24% pregnancy rate in severe male factor infertility with a 16% rate by cycle. Talk about comparing this to IUI and then also some of the limitations in comparing this to historical data with IUI.
Yeah, I think it's so I'll take this one. I think it's important to note that for the traditional IUI devices, there has been no required prospective studies, nothing required for FDA approval. So we were limited in our search for literature to try to find data to be able to make a comparison. We saw a demonstrated significantly higher pregnancy rate, whether by subject or by cycle, when compared to a historic piece of literature, albeit it was older because most of it was not studied. It was all retrospective study, and we had a difficult time trying to find literature that just exclusively looked at that male factor, where the female had no known factors. Most of the retrospective studies has a mix. Females have some issues. There were some other variables and variety. So this actual comparative study was the one we had incorporated into our FDA-approved pivotal trial, based on an extensive literature review, and that was approved ultimately by FDA for study.
And why is Femicide? Help me understand why you chose to focus the Femicide study on male factor infertility. As I understand, the study was redesigned after it was initiated. So tell me what you saw and why you chose to redefine the primary efficacy analysis.
So what we found in the original study design, when we decided to accept all female factors and all male factors, we found the female factors fell into so much of a variety where there wasn't an appropriate N in the various different factors. There was just too much variation. But the male factor, when we looked at that cohort, we explicitly eliminated any female factors. So this particular cohort is a woman with no known fertility factors, so that we could look exclusively at that male contributing factor from a data analysis standpoint. As Dr. Liu mentioned, we see such utility in the product because the product is just augmenting what normally needs to happen, as he described natural fertilization, where sperm needs to make it into the protected area of the fallopian tube. It is our goal to have a higher concentration of that limited sperm count enter into the fallopian tube where it can be protected and then, instill the ability to have pregnancy. So we are just augmenting what is supposed to happen naturally and beyond theoretical because we've shown it in the data. If you look at just male factor, which that historic literature looked at, from a 1 to 20 million is what we looked at from a total motile sperm count. We looked at that particular factor, although motility clearly is a factor as well. The historic literature actually did not cap the upper end of their sperm count. They had a limit on the front end of more than 1 million, but there was no cap on the back end. So it's very likely that the sperm included sperm counts in excess of 20 million, because back then, when a lot of this literature occurred, the sperm count was considered normal at much higher levels. Call it 40 million, 40 million as a threshold. The current now literature, which is very recent, has a threshold of 20 million. So as sperm rates or total sperm counts have declined, there's been a redefinition of what constitutes normal so that most won't be called abnormal. So this is a trend. This is a trend that we don't see reversing. We see declining sperm counts, and that's going to continue. Particularly as Dr. Liu said, there's no intervention that's working to improve these sperm counts. So we see this as continuing, and so the utility of the product and what we've demonstrated in this data set's important.
So, what was the range of sperm count for the participants included in the study? How many of these would, let's say, not recommend be recommended for IUI based on low sperm count? Is there a cutoff at which point physicians know that IUI is not necessarily recommended?
So I think there's a lot of factors that come into the decision as to whether or not someone's going to undergo an IUI. And a lot of that is financially driven. So the sperm count for the study was 1 to 20 million. Within that range, with the redefinition of normal being 20 million or higher sperm count. What we see across the nation, and this has been published as well, is that very low sperm counts, and we're going to analyze this data further by, in the stratifying between the 1 and 20, depending on how low that sperm count is, the option may be to go straight to IVF or ICSI because they would undergo multiple IUIs without success. It becomes a very financial decision. If you're talking about a couple, which about 30% of the time, it might just be strictly the male issue. The female has no known fertility issue. IVF puts her through invasive procedures, a multitude of injections, egg extraction. They have to consider the egg storage, the cost that Dr. Liu eloquently described as escalating and at a much higher level than IUI. This is strictly to bring an option to not only those people, but others that are considering insemination. So we've defined it as 1 to 20 to look at that more abnormal category, but it's strictly not just for that category of patient. A patient may have a 40 million sperm count and still say, I will never go to IVF because most never do. And I want to have something that gives us a better augmented approach to putting sperm into the tube. I'd like to also mention, and this is published nationally, that there's about 200,000 IVF cycles that are performed annually in the US. That is in stark contrast to what's being done for intrauterine insemination. So it's not, it's a very personal decision, a very personal journey, but what, we augment that natural process and we showed, very high utility in a compromised sperm count category.
I might want to add that in terms of the IUI, typically before we were looking at Femicide, if the total motile sperm, wash sperm, was less than 1 million, we discouraged couples from pursuing IUI because the success rates were under 4% total. And that is no matter how many cycles IUI is done. And so those couples generally were recommended to go to in vitro fertilization with sperm injection.
Those under 1 million.
Those under one, right,
Okay.
under 1 million. We just did not pursue IUI traditionally. Whether Femicide will change that or not, I think will depend on their sub-analysis as they look further at the data.
Right. I understand under 1 million wasn't included in the study.
We looked at 1 to 20. And then what I would say is nationally, we see in literature to support this, about 93% of couples in the range that we studied from 1 to 20 are often offered an ICSI, where their chance of success is very well defined. We know that it's successful. IVF and ICSI is a successful approach in the 40 to 50% range, depending on the center. That is not what we're trying to propose. We're looking at a step in the overall process. So for patients, and this is, there are a lot of patients with compromised sperm count, and they don't go to IVF if there's only 200,000 cycles. If there's 10 million people declared as infertile, it's just numbers. They're not going to IVF. So it's for a whole host of reasons, but this is an attempt to look at an untapped market to be able to take people that don't see an opportunity and an option, given the numbers, they're factual, 10 million, 200,000 cycles. What can we do for those patients to give them an option and an alternative?
Right. And this study did focus on male factor infertility, but do you think these results would make sense in other patient segments as well?
I mean, again, as Dr. Liu kindly laid out the biology of what needs to happen, the uterine cavity is very hostile. So, depositing the sperm through a traditional IUI method, which, by the way, is one of the oldest techniques for assisted reproductive technology. It's been around a long time. There's been nothing new in the category. There's approval since the early 70s. So being able to overcome the hostility of the uterine cavity and deposit the sperm where it ultimately needs to go can be extrapolated easily because that's what our product does. We achieve intratubal insemination without having to thread into the tube. We do it from the uterine cavity into the tube. So we've eliminated a lot of the risks associated with old technology that attempted to do this. Everyone knows that that's the biology, that ultimately the sperm needs to reach the egg in the tube. So that to me is not controversial at all. We are just aiding in that process because we are placing it directly where it needs to go. The other important factor is we can also place where she's ovulating. That's an easy determination by a physician to look under ultrasound. Where do they see the follicle? Is it on the left side? Is it on the right side? And then we can deposit the sperm directly to where she's ovulating, or if she only has one tube, we can deposit the sperm directly into that open tube. Those are very significant advantages to increase the likelihood that the sperm is going to reach the egg with the highest likelihood of conceiving. So those are all the natural things that, based on a physician's acumen and ability to identify where the follicles are. And if they enrich the follicle count, they certainly can deliver sperm to both sides. But those are all enriching. We're enriching and increasing the likelihood. And the goal is to decrease the number of cycles and to be able to bring pregnancy quicker and most and cost affordably. That's the other thing our data also presented was that most of the women that got pregnant did so on the first cycle. So again, to the theoretical support the data.
And what would be the typical cost breakdown for someone using Femicide versus IUI? How much additional cost is it adding for the patient? And then from the physician's angle as well, does it add any additional burden?
So there's no additional cost for the physician aside from the cost of the device. We were fortunate to achieve an FDA clearance from FDA far earlier than we had expected. The product was originally classified differently, which necessitated the big pivotal trial. that's one of the unique things around what we have from a commercialization standpoint. We are able to bring data to the table at the beginning of a commercial launch. A typical 510K product conducts a post-market study, and then that study, you have to wait on that data in order to help augment the commercialization effort. Because of the way that this was approved, we were running this big multi-center trial, and we've amassed this data to be able to bring that forward at the same time. So from a cost standpoint, we are now going through pricing studies so that we price this accordingly. It will be more expensive than the traditional IUI catheters, that are more of a commodity product. There's very little innovation in the way that they're designed. And so when we bring this innovative approach and the very long time it's taken us to work with FDA to get this through clearance, you know, we want to be sensitive to how we can bring this to the market, but also be sensitive to the fact that we need to stay alive as a company and be able to commercialize this. And from a cost standpoint to the patient, much of these types of procedures are passed along to the patient. We are seeing better coverage decisions. We hope that that continues, particularly with the administration showing that there's a need for us to improve women's health care at large, particularly in the reproductive area. So as we see insurance coverage improve, there'll be less burden to the patient. But this certainly excludes all the surgical interventions, all the embryo transfers, all the embryo maintenance, all of those things that get this into the six figures potentially for IVF, eliminates all of that when it's just an additional cost of the device alone.
Right. Then I think let's move on to, well, we have some time to move on to audience Q&A. We've gotten quite a few questions sent in. So I'll start with questions about the Femicide study. What was the mean and median total motile sperm count in the severe male factor infertility cohort of the Femicide trial?
So we actually, I don't have that to report. So I'm limited to the public information that we've disclosed. Top line data, it was hot off the presses. We will absolutely look at analyzing the data in a variety of different ways, including, as I mentioned, stratifying it by sperm count within the 1 to 20. So they ranged from 1 to 20, but we'll also provide that mean and median in the paper.
And then were there p-values associated with this trial? I understand it was a single arm study. So what was the effect side? Was the power that the trial was powered to detect? Is that applicable?
So this, again, medical device, this is not a pharma drug. So that's important to mention. The typical medical device trials often look at a historical control where they have a single arm, patients aren't randomized, it's not the same threshold. We have access to our data as it's ongoing, also different than pharma with a flip of a card at the end. Hence also the reason that 6.7% cycle post of extensive, exhaustive literature review was approved by FDA in the trial design to be most comparable to compare to the population that we were recruiting to prospectively for the Femicide trial. So there is no p-value. We also concluded the trial because we achieved the 510K clearance. The product was no longer deemed investigational. So the trial was no longer designed appropriately. So we concluded it, stopped enrollment, and we're able to now present data again in a more rigorous manner because this was done under an IDE FDA approved study with study sites that went through rigorous IRB approvals with a very defined patient population, again, akin to the historic control that we've described in the press release.
So let me just say, I was surprised by, pleasantly surprised by how high the pregnancy success rates were. Typically, we describe to patients with the normal IUI procedure, somewhere in the range of 10 to 15% success rates for three cycles for a typical male factor patient. And obviously, if they're under 1 million total molar sperm, we push them to IVF without really pursuing IUI. So
Mm-hmm.
I was impressed with their high numbers.
And then the next question, your reference 6.7% in IUI. I see at least one analysis showing 23.4% in IUI. Please put your success rate into context. The study in question is a 2019 retrospective study conducted in Tehran in approximately 350 patients. Can you comment on, you know, potential literature showing other benchmarks?
Yeah, I mean, this is very challenging because IUI has been around a very long time. And so the studies, again, were not done under an FDA guidance. They were not done prospectively. Most of them are done retro. In fact, almost all of them are done retrospectively. And so the picking and choosing and trying to gear up that data for the general population to review. The articles, what we've done is look to the patient population and how do we align that most closely to a historic control.
Mm-hmm.
We took explicitly 1 to 20 million as a total motile sperm count, no known fertility factor for the patient, for the woman, so that we were strictly looking at the man. We also did not require ovulation stimulation, so we did not require donor sperm. There are also many variations as far as we didn't restrict the way that the sperm was prepared. We allowed our 17 sites to prepare as they normally would per their protocol. So there was a variety of different ways in which the sperm was prepared. So there's a lot of influencers and why this study data is so impactful. It is in the hands of many sites, not a single site that has done it a certain way. We want it to be reflective of the population at large across the country and perhaps across the world. So when you do that and you have those variabilities, those affect the way that the data could be impacted. So that's why that historic control is so relevant, because we matched it in our study design, and they have professed in this similar study design without a cap of, was that the main difference was that they didn't cap their total sperm count at the upper threshold, that was 6.7% per cycle.
Okay. The next question is a little bit about the commercialization process. Do you see adoption being contingent on spending more money to educate patients, or do you feel like as though the data currently speak to themselves?
I mean, again, 510K products generally don't have data. So we feel that the data is advantageous for one segment of the market. This is certainly not everyone. But it is applicable when we think about the general biology of how conception occurs. So we do see education as being very important, that people become aware that there's something new that they could and may want to undergo for an incremental cost above a standard IUI. We're not anywhere near the neighborhood of an IVF or an ICSI or all of the things that are required as a result. And I think anyone who's in this industry, every physician, their goal is to empower couples and women to have children if that's what they should so desire. That is why they do this. And so to be able to embrace something new, to give somebody an opportunity at a lower cost threshold, just allows for practices to be able to attend to those needs. So we see a very, very positive reception from physicians, our investigators, to the physicians we've spoken to, because they want to offer more. You know, and the limitations of IVF and all of the things and the pressures, the macro issues that are occurring, just weigh into kind of people's selection of going to IVF in general. It was already hard for couples and women to choose that as an option, given how cost prohibitive it is. Making it harder is only going to make it worse. So we, as a company, feel like it's an incredible responsibility to educate the practitioners that are the front line, whether it be the OB-GYNs that see patients and refer them out, and to the infertility specialists, of which there are so few in this country doing such an important job, and having so much of these pressures, you know, facing them on how they're going to manage their practices. You know, we want to engage them so that they can offer these other additional services. And from a patient perspective, looking at cost and being sensitive to that, we have demonstrated that femicide is safe, comparable to an IUI. So it's really decisions on their pocketbooks. And if you can potentially reduce the number of cycles and be able to at least take a shot at pregnancy, we want to make sure we open that door of opportunity for patients.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we're going to try to get in two more questions with the time that we have. This one, maybe Dr. Liu can help answer. The question on 24% of women becoming pregnant after femicide, does this imply that women will seek 2, 3, or 4 cycles of treatment?
So I don't know the absolute data that femicide has on how many conceived on the first try versus the second versus the third. In general, we don't advise more than 3 cycles of IUI before moving for further intervention like in vitro fertilization, for whatever reason that the cycles have not been successful with IUI. So generally, our experience is younger women, higher sperm counts usually result in higher first cycle success rates. And then with each subsequent IUI cycle, success rates begin to plateau. And most of the data in the literature would suggest that after the third cycle, the IUI success rates are very low beyond the third cycle.
Okay. That makes sense. And the last question, this is more speculative for both of you, but what do you think is not being appreciated about the femicide data released yesterday by the market? And how does that differ from what you've heard from providers and KOLs?
I mean, I think I think everyone wants to look in the literature and say, look, we compared to this and it's so clean. IUI has been around a very long time. There is an assortment of data out there. I mean, we looked at thousands of articles. There's so much data to be able to find the historic control that would be appropriate. From that standpoint, I think it's difficult to grasp because someone might just Google search and find an article and say, well, I found 50% on an IUI, you know, and then you got to read the whole article to see that there was a whole bunch of other things and it, you know, that were attempted in addition to just a standard IUI. You also note that there's no IUI device even mentioned, like which one did they use? Because it's considered a commodity. So that's the other issue. There's like 50 that are approved in the category. So I think the top level takeaway message is, femicide is within the intrauterine category because we place our technology in the uterus, but we uniquely have an intratubal insemination nomenclature because we are placing in the tube in a safe manner, safer than our predicate that was approved in the 1980s or 1970s, where they had to put a wire into the tube to deliver the sperm. It has always been the goal, and it is a known biology that the sperm needs to make it into the safe haven of the fallopian tube. We as a company are achieving that with femicide. We took a cohort within the larger data set because that was where the bolus of patients were. We didn't want to report on one patient or two patients or three patients in a certain category. That's not notable. The notable numbers were, as you might expect, in a category where low sperm count and no known fertility factor, it migrated to that because that is understandable that if there's less sperm to deal with, you have less likelihood it's going to successfully make it into the tube. So that is a category we see natural as a natural fit to show utility for femicide. As Dr. Liu said, he was impressed with the data. We are seeing widespread people being impressed with the data that do this day in and day out as clinicians. This is meant to be a frontline, first line alternative to IUI and an option to consider prior to IVF for all the reasons we've already discussed.
Great. And then since we're at time, just wanted to see if you can give us an idea of what to expect from Femisys over the next 12 to 18 months. You know, should we expect more Femicide data at a conference or in a publication?
So we are absolutely preparing for publication. Again, unique position that we find ourselves in to be able to have any data for a 510K product launch. So we're very thrilled to be able to share that top line data in agreement that there's more to come and there's interest in kind of the details around it. But we're thrilled to be able to support our commercial launch. And that's what you'll see in the next 12 to 18 months. We will focus on the US. We have a chief commercial officer that we were able to recruit in February. We just launched our new website that features our new VP of sales and VP of marketing as we strengthen our commercial team. We're thrilled to have Dr. Liu as our chief medical officer, who is undoubtedly a thought leader in this area, has so many publications. It's been his life work to be able to help us make sure we educate patients properly and his fellow colleagues properly as we introduce this product to the market. We will also amass additional country approvals as we continue. We do not see this as a US only issue. This is a global crisis. When we talk about fertility, it's a global crisis when we talk about folks that are seeking insemination. So we want to make sure that we get this product out to the world at large. So those are the things to come for Femisys. And again, I'll reemphasize that we're comfortable with our cash position, that we feel that we were fortunate to be able to raise capital in a very undoubtedly difficult market the end of last year to support the effort laid out. We'll certainly be opportunistic with certainly women's health initiatives out of the administration to seek non-dilutable capital to be able to continue to support this effort. And we'll also look to launch additional products within our women's health portfolio. As we invest in a commercial team, we will make sure that they're enriched to be able to bring other products to the forefront as well.
Well, great. Thanks so much, everybody, for joining our webinar. Thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Dr. Liu.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Have a great afternoon.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.